Hi there. Welcome back to another episode of the Addiction Audio Podcast. My name is Ben Scher, and I'm delighted to be joined today by three academics who have recently published in the Addiction Journal. So we're joined by Dr. Michael Liebrenz from the University of Bern, Alexander Smith, who's also at the University of Bern, and Dr. Adam Backer, who is a GP in central London. So they recently published a commentary letter, which is one of the forms of articles that are accepted in Addiction Journal, in response to a recent paper by Domzaridou et al. But before we dive into the research, I was just wondering if you could each kind of introduce yourselves and just give a little background on your areas of research and what you do on a day-to-day. So Dr. Liebrenz, maybe if we start with you.
Of course, I'd glad to talk about my work and what I focus on. I started out in general psychiatry, where I got really interested in how people struggle with substance use. And this led me to a job in a special part of the Psychiatric University Hospital in Zurich, where we treated patients dealing with both mental health and substance use issues like dual diagnosis. And working there, I came across a lot of legal questions related to these patients, which got me really interested in how psychiatry and the law come together. And this interest then led me to forensic psychiatry, which has been a big part of my work since then. I started an outpatient clinic for people who've committed crimes and also have substance use problems. And this clinic has been key in giving these patients the specific help they need. On the research side, my team and I have looked into many different topics related to substance use. For example, we've studied how patients with schizophrenia view cannabis use, and we've looked into other ways to help people with severe benzodiazepine dependency besides just telling them stop, withdraw, you know, just completely stop with it. We've also looked at how heroin treatment can be used in prison. So heroin assisted treatment. When other treatments like methadone or buprenorphine haven't worked. So that's about my background.
No, fascinating. Thank you. So moving on to Dr. Adam Backer.
Yes, hello. Well, I'm a GP and I work in a rather deprived area of central London. And I have a special interest in the treatment of addiction, but I'm a normal NHS GP. I'm not a researcher. I'm a hands-on clinician. But in the past, patients who dropped out of our local drug dependency units often came to me, and many of them actually had also a big benzo problem. And I did prescribe benzo maintenance treatment for quite a few of them. So, you know, when this became more and more controversial, I did an audit of my work and had quite some surprising findings, really. And I wrote that up and managed to get that published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology.
Brilliant. And Alex Smith.
Yeah, so I'm a senior researcher in the Department of Forensic Psychiatry, St. Michael's Department at the University of Bern. My academic background is both non-medical and non-clinical, falling in the social science and humanities. So with that in mind, I'm primarily interested in aspects of drug policy and the societal context surrounding substance use, but also how to protect the rights and needs of individuals living with addiction, and how to improve the conditions of people with substance-related vulnerabilities. As a department, some of our recent research, I think Michael covered a lot of it, but we've also looked at how substance use is reflected in socio-cultural productions and vice versa. And we're also very interested in advocating for the human rights of patients and individuals who use drugs, particularly amidst repressive drug policy frameworks, for example, during the war on drugs in parts of Southeast Asia, like the Philippines.
Brilliant. And so just to start here, first question, maybe we'll start with you, Adam, as first author of this commentary piece. Could you just give us a brief overview of the Domzaridou article and kind of what compelled you to write a response?
Okay, well, this study looked at the non-fatal overdose risks of people on a variety of medications that are commonly co-prescribed in opiate substitution treatment. and a Domsarido Examiner computer database, enormous database that covered nearly 20% of primary care prescribing in the UK. And she looked for the patients who were prescribed methadone or buprenorphine, particularly for addiction. And they analyzed a 20-year period, and they found some 20,000 patients and had accumulated some 80,000 treatment years, so massive cohort. And then they looked at another database that held information on hospital admissions, and they counted the number of overdose admissions that these patients had during their treatment period. And then worked out the overdose risk of the people that they co-prescribed certain drugs in comparison to the other people in their sample that were not prescribed that particular drug. And so they found, for instance, that the people that co-prescribed benzodiazepines had a 30% higher overdose risk than others that were not prescribed benzodiazepines, and people that prescribed antipsychotics had a 47% higher overdose risk. For me, actually, the most interesting finding was the subsequent sub-analysis, because they also looked at every cohort of patients. So if they, for instance, if they looked at the people that were prescribed benzos, they also had periods that they were not prescribed these drugs, and did also a risk assessment of these periods. And the outcome of that was that for the benzo patients in particular, there was no significant difference whether they were prescribed benzos or not in their treatment journey.
So just from a kind of from a methods perspective, you've read this article, you've identified that you want to do a response. How do you then kind of form a team, and how did you link up with Michael and with Alex to do this?
Oh, well, that's quite a long story. My first impression of the paper was probably not another one of those studies telling us there's an interaction between these drugs, because we all know that it's been in the BNF since I was a medical student, and we are forever being told not to co-prescribe benzos. And in fact, the Westminster Shared Care Scheme withdraws funding for patients that are co-prescribed benzodiazepines. So you might well ask, why do doctors do it? Well, in my opinion, it's an attempt to control chaotic drug use by giving modest doses in small installments. So I wrote the first draft of the paper, which was rejected, and then I thought, well, I'd really feel driven to respond to this. So I reached out to some people that I actually had a little bit of email correspondence with after a conference, and I thought we were sort of on the same wavelength. And I asked them whether they would like to be co-author.
Michael, when you first read this paper, and then were contacted by Adam to assist with the response, what were your initial impressions, and kind of, yeah, what was your thinking going through this commentary?
So something that really stood out for me in this study was defining that prescribing antipsychotics along with methadone or buprenorphine actually posed a greater risk for non-fatal overdoses than combining them with benzos. And I didn't see that being like discussed in the article. So clinically, we often prefer to co-prescribing antipsychotics rather than benzos, especially for off-label uses like helping patients to sleep, because it is seen safer or considered safer. And I thought when I saw that, you know, this point from the study is quite crucial, and I think we should, you know, spread this message a little bit more widely. And like for the first part of your question, when Adam reached out with his initial comment, it immediately caught my attention, because we had connected a few years earlier, just like you said. And our interaction at the time was related to an article which had actually been published in Addiction, which focused on agonist substitution as a treatment alternative for patients depending on high-dose benzodiazepines. In that article, we proposed an alternative to just basically traditional withdrawal methods, basically saying or arguing that maybe we should maintain those patients who have failed traditional withdrawal with putting them over to slow onset and long-acting benzodiazepines. And this was back in 2010, and we received a lot of criticism for this. And Adam was one of the few who, you know, reached out and then said, you know, sharing his clinical experiences, and it aligned with our suggestion. And that was, you know, back then when we didn't have Zoom and you know, just email, basically. I mean, we did have phone, but, you know, receiving such an email was incredibly validating and helpful when you are under such criticism from other really well-known researchers. So when he contacted us to work on this new commentary, and we felt like a natural continuation of our previous collaboration. And so, you know, we just said, yeah, let's go ahead. And then Alex stepped in.
In your commentary, in the response, you push us to kind of consider how patients can find stability in what can be often quite chaotic lifestyles associated with patients who are accessing buprenorphine, but also methadone treatment. What do you think are the implications for the broader field of addiction medicine when looking at pharmacological interventions versus more lifestyle-focused interventions? And how do we strike up the balance between the two?
They go hand in hand, of course. I mean, it's not just pharmacology. We do all the general health support. We help them with housing. We give vaccinations. We support them in education, help them find jobs, education, benefits, all of it.
Your commentary also mentions the challenges that can sometimes be associated with treatment services and the challenge they have in engaging patients with opioid dependency who are also using benzodiazepines. From all three of you, from your experience both in research but also within services and practicing, what are some strategies that can be effective in really helping people engage with services?
So, I mean, if we look at those, because the article also, you know, took out again the benzodiazepine aspect in patients who are in opioid agonist treatment. And if you look at those patients, and especially those with a high dose dependence, they usually use these fast acting and short duration types. And then they experience memory impairments or show disinhibited behavior. Then they might try to obtain benzodiazepines prescriptions from multiple doctors. That's always an additional problem. They get involved in the legal system, and then they have these numerous problems. And therefore, this in a holistic approach is absolutely crucial. And, you know, effective strategies in dealing with these patients can be the controlled dispensation of medications so that they don't, you know, use it from or don't get it from different multiple pharmacies. Another strategy is, again, switching these patients from fast-acting, short-duration benzos to slower onset and longer action. And then what, however, doesn't work in the clinical reality is that you just, or that doctors or therapists just end the treatment as a disciplinary measure without providing these patients a clear path forward. And it is just not very effective, and it doesn't address the complexities and the situation in which these patients are. So, and when it comes to choosing between buprenorphine and methadone, it's key to involve the patient in this decision-making process, essentially making them the expert of their own treatment. And this involves helping them to make an informed choice, in my mind, and regularly checking to ensure that the treatment is really effective. Meaning, and then again, what is effectiveness? Does it so that it prevents any additional consumption of heroin? So I think that's what I would take out of this.
That's fascinating. And Alex, before we came on air and started recording, you mentioned that the way that you approach this topic is through a social science background, and like myself, you're a PhD student. So yeah, I'd just be really interested to hear kind of your perspective on this commentary, and yeah, from that more social science.
I think one of the things that comes through, and it's challenging to an extent because we're sort of in an awkward position in a sense, because we've obviously provided some comments on this paper, and perhaps disagree with a few things on this paper. But I think what's coming through from Adam and Michael from the clinician side of things is just how complex this patient community is, and how marginalized this patient community is. And even in, you know, academic research, that might be deliberate because of stigma, or it might be non-deliberate just because of the issues of recruiting the sample and ethical sensitivities and things like that. So I think although we've provided sort of to an extent critical comments on this paper, I think all three of us would applaud the intention of the authors and commend the intention of the authors to conduct research on this population and to try and improve conditions in this population. And even what Adam was saying, it's a population with a lot of complex needs. So I think, and everyone always says we need to do more research, but I think really in this population that sentiment rings true. So I think just to emphasize that we do applaud the intentions of the authors for their work and for their idea behind the paper, basically.
No, and I'm glad you brought that up, because actually, for those listening, the Addiction Audio Podcast did record a podcast with the original author. So if you if you want, go check that out. You can also read their paper in the Addiction Journal as well.
Yes, I agree with Alex. Definitely, we need a bit more research. It's actually remarkable that in the last 40 years, there's only been one randomized controlled trial testing the value of benzodiazepine maintenance in opioid patients to the benzo problem. And benzodiazepine codependence would seem such an obvious target for harm reduction, because so many studies have found that among opioid maintenance patients, the ones who use illicit benzos are the ones that do particularly badly. More than 40 years of research in opioid substitution treatment has indicated that it's these patients that are more likely to share needles, use cocaine, have suicidal ideation, and they also have more frequent contact with the police. And they are more likely to carry bloodborne viruses, have alcohol or mental health issues, and have a much, much higher mortality. And all these factors are probably just associated with illicit benzo use and not likely to be not caused by it. And Domzaridou's study seems to support this, because they found that the overdose risk remains elevated in the people during periods on benzos as well as off benzos. And also they're finding patients on benzodiazepine prescriptions had a slightly higher overdose risk. Hardly comes as a surprise, because they started at a high risk to begin with. So this superpopulation is notoriously difficult to engage, but we should go the extra mile to retain them in treatment because of this high mortality. We of course know that prescribing benzos improves treatment retention. It's probably the only thing that is not controversial about benzos. But in our opinion, the whole raft of behavioral risks associated with illicit benzo use can be mitigated to some extent by prescribing moderate doses of benzodiazepines in small installments. Substitution treatment is actually a subtle way of introducing your lifestyle. This is true for benzos as well as for opioid substitution treatment. And modifying the lifestyle is what ultimately leads to good treatment outcomes. Unfortunately, there seems to be such a reluctance to conduct research that might support benzo maintenance prescribing. However, the findings of the one and only controlled trial on this issue, when they compared clonazepam with placebo in methadone maintenance patients, the findings were really quite positive, confirming that there is a sound logic for benzodiazepine maintenance treatment for this population. But ideally, we need some larger randomized controlled trials.
So do you think these findings and your perspective on this have any implications for clinicians who are prescribing or who might have come across this research?
Well, yes, of course, because lots of clinicians do actually prescribe benzo, and probably on the same wavelength. But we're all made to feel very guilty about it. We've told we shouldn't do this, but in effect we do, and there is a reason for that, because we see the patients, and we know how they respond.
Yeah.
picking up on Adam, I think what this is all about, it's accepting clinical reality. So if you have 30 or in my case, 20 years of experience with dealing with these patients, you know that this is a clinical reality and it's the elephant in the room. And of course, it's the easiest way to say, all right, we're going to withdraw these patients, right? But what if this doesn't work? I mean, all their problems just don't go away. And as a forensic psychiatrist, I see that they are then going in and out of prison, where there's a whole set of other problems. So they're there, where they are then forcefully withdrawn. And on the other hand, we know that especially if someone is, if his treatment is terminated or withdrawn forcefully in a prison setting, then his risk for mortality increases because people are not receiving psychoeducation or what happens when they are losing their tolerance. So I think this is a very complex system, and this issue of benzodiazepine co-prescription is a clinical reality, and we need to have like a collaborative approach. And again, I think the stigma for those who just face clinical reality is something that is very surprising in our world with all these publications possible. Let's put it this way.
And Alex, just to finish off, just on that final point, did you have any views on just from the stigma perspective why that might be the case, and how what we might be able to do to combat the stigma of this co-prescribing?
I think just more collaborations and more interdisciplinary collaborations, especially so from the perspective of like the clinical perspective. A lot of clinicians just simply aren't able to publish research because they don't have the time to publish research or anything like that, and I think the clinical reality can be often, as you've heard, often ignored in these wider dialogues. So I think more interdisciplinary collaborations between people doing the research and people who are actually treating these patients, I think, would be really valuable. And I feel like I've just said more research quite a lot of times, but
it's always a good
question, I think.
Brilliant. Well, Alex, Adam, and Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
You guys, and if you want to read their commentary, if you want to read the original paper, if you want to listen to the original podcast that was done with Nomzaridou, please go ahead and check out the Addiction Journal and the Addiction Audio podcast. But thank you very much for joining us, and see you next time.